You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
I kind of like being the underdog and I like being underestimated. I think it's a lot easier to be underestimated and feel like you have fight and grit and you can prove yourself.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to No Limits. I'm your host, Rebecca Jarvis. If you are a frequent listener here, thank you. We appreciate your loyalty. And if you're new, welcome. Each week, we work here to demystify success. I know it's a weird word, doesn't mean everything to everyone, but the idea is happiness in the work that you do in your life. And we go about finding that by speaking to the world's most influential women across all different industries. And the conversations go beyond the resume, from decision-making to trade-offs to those pivotal moments that shape your careers and your lives. So whether you're looking for advice or you just want to hear a good story, you've come to the right place. Okay, listeners, we have a real treat today. With us in the hot seat is Katrina Lake. She's the founder and CEO of Stitch Fix. She's the youngest woman ever to take a company public. You were 34 years old.
That's right.
When Stitch Fix went public, it's listed on the NASDAQ. That was in 2017. And in less than 10 years, she's grown Stitch Fix from an idea to a company that generates more than $1.5 billion in sales and serves more than 3 million clients. You've been named one of Forbes's richest self-made women. And you're also a mother of two. You're on the board of Glossier and Grubhub. And you're a guest on the season 11 of Shark Tank. Welcome, Katrina, to No Limits.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
I love that you're here. Also, by the way, there is a Minnesota connection here, and I can't not mention the Minnesota connection. Katrina went to high school in Minneapolis.
That's right. I did go to the state fair every year still.
What's your favorite thing to eat on a stick?
The Pronto Pup is really good. I really like the pickle on a stick.
Oh,
controversial,
yeah.
But I like that one.
Why is it controversial?
I don't know. Some people are
fried?
Like, why would you go all the way to the state fair to have a pickle?
The Pronto Pup, by the way, is basically like the hot dog, like the corn dog.
It's like
isn't
a corn
it?
Dog, but they're very particular that it's not a corn dog. It's a Pronto Pup.
I wonder why that is. I mean, I obviously go to the state fair, but I've never investigated the difference between a Pronto Pup and a corn dog.
It would be great investigative journalism.
I, by the way, like the cheese on a stick, deep fried cheese.
Oh, yes, the cheese curds, the cookies, those are really good.
But enough about food, also another favorite topic of mine. Let's talk about you and your childhood, your parents. Was starting a company, was that something that your family, if you had said as a kid, I want to start a company, would that surprise your parents?
I did a lot of crazy things. I don't know that anything necessarily surprised my parents, but it was, I don't think that they would have predicted this path. But I had a great childhood. I was in a bilingual, bicultural household. My mom is an immigrant from Japan. My dad was a doctor. He's a liver transplant doctor. He's at the University of Minnesota. My mom is a public school teacher. So, you know, they really were like education first, mm-hmm. like very invest in your education. But they also were, I would say, like more on the academic side and not necessarily on the like capitalist entrepreneurial side. I like as a kid, I didn't have a lemonade stand. Like I didn't have dreams of being an entrepreneur.
What? You can't be an entrepreneur if you didn't have a lemonade stand.
I know,
I'm really sorry to break it to you, Katrina.
I read all these fun anecdotes about like so-and-so had this, you know, cookie business growing up or
she
whatever.
She carried her little briefcase everywhere.
Yep, yeah. Nope, not me.
What would you want? Did you have a dream as a kid of a dream job?
I think I wanted to be a doctor. And, you know, my dad is a doctor. I had a lot of respect for the profession he was in. I liked math and science. And then I went to college. I was pre-med. I even took the MCAT. I think the way it kind of happened was I was volunteering in a hospital. It's kind of like a hospital lab environment. And I just had this moment of, you know, I didn't feel super comfortable around like bodily fluids and just the atmosphere of being a doctor. And I just had this moment of feeling like this I don't know that this is the work environment for me. Like, if you think about, you're going to spend like 12 hours a day someplace, like, I didn't feel super comfortable like wearing latex gloves and scrubs. And I just had this moment of feeling like this just doesn't feel right. And so I postponed even applying to medical school, and I had done an economics degree, which was kind of, I don't want to say that was luck, but it was like I had taken some economics classes and I was like, I love this. This is like math and the real world put together, and it was interesting. And so I leaned on that and took a job in consulting. And that was really meant to be a stopgap of like, I can do this for 2 years, learn about business, and then I can apply to medical school. But I really just got sucked into the business world and really loving this idea of like building businesses and understanding what makes, you know, ultimately consumers and people tick, and, you know, building businesses around that. And so that was kind of how I stumbled into this entrepreneurship path.
Did you like consulting?
Some elements of it I loved. I loved the people that I worked with. I mean, and actually, I met my husband through that. And so we didn't date when we were working together. But you worked with really smart, interesting people. And you worked on really interesting problems for companies. And so I got to work with, like, I don't know if I'm supposed to name the companies, but I worked with like eBay, and I worked with other big retailers that were in the brick and mortar world. Restaurant clients.
Because you don't always get to work with. So I started in investment banking out of college, also met my husband, also waited to date him until he quit. But I feel like consulting and banking are very similar postgraduate programs, where there's a lot of young people because they have a specific program where analysts, or, you know, whatever the title of the program is, you come straight out of college and you get a lot of access.
Right.
But not a lot. I didn't love them. I hated it, actually, to be honest. I really hated it because the hours are very intense.
Well, and that's why I quit, was really the hours. Like, I had the same experience. I was like, I love the work, and it's so interesting, and you get to meet so many companies and great people. But I had the exact same experience, where in the end, like, I quit right at my 2 year mark, which is kind of, I don't know if yours
same
is
thing.
Like, I quit right at 2 years because I was working like 90 hours a week or something, and traveling a lot, and I just, like, I couldn't, you know, it wasn't the lifestyle for me.
Did you have a plan when you quit?
I already had a job lined up. Like, my thought process was, I came to love business, and I especially retail apparel, I felt like was super interesting, where there was a huge market and no one was really innovating in any kind of interesting way. And so I was hoping actually to get a job at like whatever company would be the future of retail. And I spent a lot of time kind of looking and, you know, applying for jobs, and didn't really find that. And so I applied to work at a venture fund, thinking, okay, like, if I don't see the future of retail in today's retailers, then maybe it's, you know, something that's going to be up and coming. And so I applied to venture capital jobs, thinking like, this is a way that I can meet an entrepreneur that I can then join. I met hundreds of entrepreneurs, and I met Polyvore as an example. I met with this guy, Charlie Graham, who started a company called Shop It To Me. And so, you know, I met a few that were in the space that were doing something interesting. But ultimately, what the venture world actually showed to me was that, like, all these people who are entrepreneurs were actually like not that quote unquote qualified. Like, they were all, you know, I kind of felt like, why would I start a business? What qualifications do I have? I had never even managed a person before I started Stitch Fix. And so I was like, what capabilities or skills do I have? And I realized that, like, everybody else doesn't really have skills or capabilities either. They just have an idea and ambition. And so for me, it actually provided inspiration that, hey, if I wanted to be part of the future of retail, that, like, I could create it myself.
So talk a little bit. I feel like Stitch Fix is so ubiquitous now, people know it. But talk a little bit about what it is today versus what you thought it might be back then.
I mean, what it is today is we really are making this idea of personal styling, a personalized shopping experience, and making that really scalable. And so, I mean, some of the original thesis really was around kind of this marriage of both, like, what you can do with data, and, like, I'm 5'2". There's all kinds of, like, beautiful clothes on this world that, like, are not going to look good on me. And so it was this insight that I think using data to interpret and understand people and garments and clothing is going to be helpful. And actually, I love Minneapolis as the example of, like, I feel like you could go into Dayton's and,
yes,
like, people would know you and they would know your family, and you'd go into Dayton's and discover new things.
I miss Dayton's.
And I know, I miss Dayton's too. It was such a great experience, and the people who work there loved working there and loved helping you. And And there was some of this like kind of old school department store that like I wanted to bring back, of just like the idea that the person that you're transacting with like knows you and knows your family mm-hmm. and can recommend things to you. And so it was kind of this marriage of like, how can you make that experience scalable? How can you do it online? And then how can you also bring in kind of the smartness of what you can learn from data and understanding products and people and marry the two together? And so the original thesis was like marrying kind of humans and data and analytics can help to build this personalized shopping experience that helps people to be able to find clothes that they love better and really transforms the way that people shop. And so historically, that's really all been through this, like what we call a fix of like you sign up, you let us know your size and style preferences. A stylist will use that great technology that we have to send you items to try on in your own home. And we've built this amazing personalization muscle to do that. And so it's kind of incredible that to this date, we've sold about $5 billion of clothes, all sight unseen. And that's kind of an amazing thing that no one is clicking on something, adding it to their cart and buying. This is all 100% of that is recommended to our clients. In building that business, what we realize now is that we have this amazing asset in that ability to personalize. You know, I think historically, all of our business really has been in fixes. And in the future, we're excited to use that platform in new ways. And so today, it's still in a test, but we have a thing called Shop Your Looks, which actually allows people now to add things to a cart and check out and buy. And it's been remarkably successful and also like radically different from regular e-commerce, where we're not showing you everything we have in our inventory. At any given time, we might have tens of thousands of things to show you, and we're really only showing you like 30 items mm-hmm. and then driving conversion off of that. And so it's this really radical way to think about e-commerce that's not searching and paging through, you know, all this stuff and filtering through all the product in the planet. It's a really focused, really personalized selection, you know, is potentially, you know, bringing that personal shopping experience online, where instead of walking into a Dayton's and having somebody, you know, pick out 30 things for you, that actually could happen online in a way that actually is really compelling. I think the business has always been about personalization. It's always been about how do we help people to find clothes that they love better. And I think now we're, you know, excited to show that that can actually take, you know, more form factors than I think the Stitch Fix that people originally knew and loved.
First of all, it is really smart what you've done. And I applaud you not just for figuring it out and having this idea, but also figuring out a way to make that idea come to life. And I want to kind of go through the tea leaves on that, because obviously having this big grand vision and then making it into what is today a $2 billion business are two very different things. One thing I think, and I hear this almost universally from so many people, and it goes back to this idea about Dayton's and the experience, shopping is not enjoyable anymore. I mean, there are people out there who never liked shopping, but there are a lot of people who actually liked it previously. And if you're in the store now, oftentimes they don't have the sizes or the items that you need, and it can always be ordered. But the whole point of being in the store, at least in my opinion, is so that you can try it on there and see it. But then when you're online, it's just this gigantic abyss of options. And that whole idea of discovery, discovering a new brand or discovering something that is going to look great on you, that you're going to feel great about, it's so much more difficult now than it used to be. Obviously, this is not the biggest problem in the world. I'm not pretending that it's like the thing, but it's an issue. And that's something that you guys have really thought through.
It is a real issue. And I would argue that it is potentially like a global issue of, I think, you know, some of the solution to, well, it's hard to find things, has been like an overconsumption where people are buying all kinds of fast fashion and you're just buying things because they're cheap and not because you love them or they fit you really well. And so I think, you know, now more than ever, it's really important to be able to help people to navigate through the literally millions of things out there. And jeans are a really great example, where the idea of trying to find a pair of jeans by looking at pictures online is just like an enormously impossible proposition. Yes. And that's where I think being able to marry technology, where we know we can pattern recognize between people who have bodies like yours and clients that we've served in the past, to be able to better target and recommend products that are more likely to work for you. I think this is actually part of the reason that it's amazing. All the things that we buy online, like we buy most things online at this point, 80% of clothes are still bought in stores.
Right.
Like, it's amazing. Like,
yeah.
It's just crazy to think online has been so kind of like not
pervasive,
good enough.
Yeah. But not getting it done.
Exactly.
But do you think that's because of who's buying? Is it that the audience of people who are shopping for clothes skews older? Therefore, there's less of a comfort with the technology?
I think originally that was true. You look at like my 65-year-old mom in outside of Minneapolis is like buying everything online, and she's she still likes going into stores too. She's like, she sent me an Anne emoji the other day. I mean, it's just like it's amazing what I mean,
love it when my mom chooses the emojis, and I'm like, wow, mom, what made you choose that one? I'd like to get in your head and understand this. Okay, so back to this idea. You have this really big idea and you set out to launch. How did you put it together in the beginning? Because your background, you said it, you had the business background from going to business school. You had a little bit of a tech and math background, but building out that technology is a huge task.
Oh, yeah. And I was, to be really clear, I was definitely not capable or like had the skill set to do that. What's kind of amazing and even more so now than in 2011 when I started is like there's all kinds of free off the shelf things that you can use to just build a business, like the URL.
Yes.
They just had a landing
Stitch
page.
Fix.
Yes. I think, well, we had one name before Stitch Fix and then it was Stitch Fix. And it was just a landing page that said, hey, we're a styling service. We're in beta. If you want to learn more, click here. And then that spit you out to a SurveyMonkey, and then you would fill out a SurveyMonkey form that let me know like who you are, where you live, what kinds of things you were looking for. And then we basically, that was kind of a wait list. And
how did you get people to that site in the first place? Was it all friends and family?
It was all friends and family. Like we had something like 29 clients, and it was 35 clients, and it was 110 clients. Those are like the month by month number of people we are adding. And it was really, truly just friends and family of like, you just blast it out to your email, post it on probably like Facebook at the time.
Begging people to just
and
take
just
the
say,
survey
like,
monkey.
Try it.
Like, it's so,
yeah.
But I bet, okay, I have no idea if this was the case. Great idea, but I bet it was frustrating back then. You're like, why is it so hard to get people to take this SurveyMonkey
thing? No, people, what was remarkable, and this is what gave me confidence the whole time, was that people actually love taking out, like filling out the survey.
That's
and then
great.
People would PayPal me $20, and that $20 styling fee really came from this early days of like, I didn't want to just blindly send somebody that I didn't know clothes. I didn't know that I would ever get them back.
Right.
And so I figured like if someone is willing to PayPal me $20, they're probably not going to steal from me. and so I would have people PayPal me $20. And so for 6 months, I mean, we probably shipped a couple thousand fixes without even having a website. And so people would, no joke, people would write down their credit card number. They're like, I'd rather give you my credit card number than PayPal you. And so in the return like shipment, they would write down their credit card number on a piece of paper. And then I would type that into like our Braintree account and shred it. Like that's when I would work.
That's extremely
when
trusting.
I would do like, I would pull all nighters in the early days, like doing things like that of like manual data entry because we didn't have a website. But the flip side was that it made it even more compelling because it was like, if clients are willing to put up with this crazy purchase funnel that is super manual and ridiculous, and if people are, imagine if we had a website, like how much better this whole experience would be and how many more people would want to try it. And so, you know, I think, and you can build things in this really scrappy way to be able to show that there's product market fit, to be able to show that there is somebody out there that wants your product. And it's such an incredible thing, I think, with the democratization of the internet now. And, you know, you see influencers who can build $100,000, million-dollar businesses because you can do, now you can do Shopify, you can do, you know, there's all kinds of payment processing that's a lot easier. And so it's just like incredible now that there are so many tools that make it so that it's much easier today to build that, you know, to build a business from zero to 100,000 or zero to $1 million than it was 10, 15 years ago.
What was the biggest challenge back then? And what is the biggest challenge today? Hear more from Katrina Lake after a word from our sponsor.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Libsyn ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Libsyn ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
What was the biggest challenge back then, and what is the biggest challenge today?
One of the biggest challenges, hiring is just always, you know, consistently even then, people. And you can have the most amazing idea in the world, but at the end of the day, like, it's up to you and your team and your ability to create a vision and motivate your team for that idea to come to life. And, you know, in those early days, I was really lucky to have two people who are still on my team, of Mike Smith, who had been the COO of Walmart.com, and he joined about a year in, and Eric Colson, who ran all of algorithms and analytics at Netflix, who also joined in about the first year or so.
Did you kind of target them given their backgrounds and think like this is the team I need in place to execute this vision?
I targeted a bunch of people that I was like, I'd love to have a chance to meet. And then, and you know, in both of these cases, luckily, I think with Mike, he was actively looking, and this was kind of the right type of opportunity he was looking for. And with Eric, we kind of like reeled him in over time of like, first I was like, will you take a meeting with me? He lived in Los Altos, but he was luckily going to a Giants game and was coming up to the city. And so I had like a drink with him and then convinced him to be an advisor, and then gradually got him more and more interested. And he was like, can I have a Stitch Fix email address? Can I have a Stitch Fix machine? Can I have periodic data dumps?
Did you give him the Stitch Fix email address right away?
Oh, of course. Okay. Yes. I was like, oh, sure. Be my guest. And he just got so interested in kind of the possibility with all of the data. My point is, more in the early days, like, recruiting was really, it was really what was going to make the difference of like, we're going to get to $1 billion or not. Being able to have people on the team that had been to $1 billion before, that could understand, yes, how do you build and operate a $1 billion business? Like, I had no idea. I was literally like shipping boxes on Monday, like taping boxes shut, like steaming clothes on my own. I'd never touched anything close to $1 billion, right? And so to be able to be surrounded by people who had seen that and knew how to build that was super valuable. And then even today, you know, today we're doing a lot of crazy, interesting things with our business model and doing things in a different way. And so much of our future is dependent on our people and our talent and our ability to recruit the best talent to be able to help us to get to where we know we can go. I mean, raising money, we can talk about raising money. Raising money was really like a challenge, where that was probably more of the life or death situation that we had in
the
early days.
Tell me about that.
I mean, raising money for this business has never been easy. Even the IPO, honestly, wasn't easy. And
because of who the investors are?
I think that plays a part in it. Certainly in the early stages, it played a big part in it. You know, I think there's been a lot of attention on this now, and I think there's been some change. But
the idea that venture, 2% of venture goes to women, essentially.
Exactly. When I was raising money, it was like 96% of venture investors are men. And even if you, and if you looked at like dollars deployed, I'll bet the numbers were even worse. I'll bet it was like 98% or even more, because, you know, a lot of times you would have a venture partner, in quotes, who was a woman who actually, you know, didn't have as much influence in the partnership as a lot of the men did. And so the result of that was that it was a lot harder for me to get people excited about the business. And like, our numbers were amazing. Like, we had a great team. We got to a lot of this like final round song and dance with venture investors. And then at the very end, I think it was just, you know, and I had one venture investor who told me, and I'm grateful he did, and he was just like, look, I love my job. Like, I get to take one or two board seats a year, and I want to take board seats where I feel like a real connection to the business. I wake up thinking about it, and where I feel like I can really add value to you as a board member, and that you, and I can be one of your most trusted, most value-add board members. And he was like, I just feel like I can't wake up in the morning thinking about women's dresses. You know, now we have men's and kids, but at the time we only had women's.
Yes.
And he was like, I feel like I can't wake up in the morning thinking about women's dresses. And I feel like I'm not going to be able to add a lot of value to you as a board member. And it's just heartbreaking, because I understand that deeply. You mentioned the boards that I'm on. I'm on those boards because I like have a connection with the founder, because I have a connection with the business, and I really love the business. And, you know, I've said no to boards where I haven't felt a connection to the business.
Right.
And so, like, I want him to love his job, and I want him to be able to do that. But at the same time, when everybody making those decisions is kind of looking at a similar, you know, kind of reference point, then like I remember there was like a T-ball app that got funded at the time that I was trying to fundraise. And it was so frustrating. I'm like, how big of a market can like managing your T-ball league be?
Oh, my gosh.
But it's like, you know, that was a more understood problem set than the like, how do you find jeans that fit you well? How do you?
Someone wanted to wake up every day thinking about T-ball.
Right. Can you believe?
That's really sad.
It was so frustrating. It's like it had group ordering of T-ball t-shirts or uniforms or whatever. I was like, oh, man.
But actually, one thing I appreciate about you sharing that anecdote is that I think that it defines the problem more clearly in some ways than what we've heard, what I've heard in these conversations previously. I don't mean to say people haven't said it. This idea that people who take board seats, they have to love the business and they have to be really excited about it, like the boards that you're on with Glossier and Grubhub. That creates complexity, I think, in solving this issue.
Right. And that I think, was
unless
the part...
more women and minorities have access to capital and are at the top of these companies and are partners within and are making the decisions.
Exactly. And I think that's the part that is so hard, is that every person, like all the bias is really created at the margin on decisions like these. Like nobody, I mean, very few people are out there saying like, I want a world where only white men are ruling. Like no one is actually like actively trying to do that, but at the margin where it's like, okay, well, there's this one guy and we have a lot in common and I really love spending time with him and we can go get beers all the time and talk about it, the business together. Or there's this woman or, you know, person of color or whatever, like at that margin, like it's a lot easier and more comfortable to say yes to the thing that's more comfortable. And so that's how the bias gets propagated. And the real problem is that there's just like the dollars deployed, the people in power, the people with influence, all kind of look similar. And then it just kind of is the self-propagating thing, and especially in venture. And when your starting point is 96% of people are men, like that's a really tough starting point. And, you know, I think we're starting to see, you know, and boards as an example.
Yes.
And I think the California legislation has had a lot to do with this. You are starting to see people focus more on diversity in boards, and you are seeing the management teams, as people are building out their management teams, actively trying to focus more on diversity. But, you know, some of these industries, and venture is one of those, it's really, really a slow cycle and it's really hard to change.
So you were the youngest woman to take a company public, 2017, you were 34 years old. Obviously, no matter who you are, there's a huge amount riding on that IPO. When you make a decision to take a company public, there's a huge amount riding. What were you thinking in that run-up to going public?
If I'm totally honest with you, I had no time to think about the gravity of the situation running up to it, honestly. You know, we had... I would say like probably a year or two, probably 2 years even before that, it was pretty clear that this company should go public.
What made it clear that it should go
public?
We were
profitable. We've been profitable since 2014.
That hasn't stopped a lot of companies,
well, that's
Katrina,
true.
From going public. But you had been profitable for how long?
We have been profitable since 2014. And we had really aggressive revenue trajectories where we had done $700 million, it was $900 million, it was over $1 billion. And the last 2 years, we've grown at 26% year over year on a very large base. And so it was clear that we could be public, and and it felt like we should be public. We still had a ton of future opportunity ahead, some of what we talked about recently with the product innovation. Then it was really a question of when. And I think for me, when was like, first of all, it was in between my two kids, right? So there was like a personal element of this, of like I had.
Did
I
you
was,
time it?
I, in some way, it had to be timed this way. I mean, I came back from maternity leave from my first kid in January, and we started working on the IPO. And so, you know, it couldn't really happen while I was out on mat leave. And it, you know, we did probably a little bit of prep before. And so, I mean, honestly, like that was actually part of the timing. And then part of the timing was also just the predictability of the business. And we wanted to be at a place where we felt like the business was predictable. And, you know, in the crazy growth rate years, like honestly, the business just wasn't predictable enough for us to be able to feel like we could with confidence go out and tell shareholders like, this is what you can expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we kind of got to the point where we felt like the business was more predictable, we had more control over the business, then it felt like kind of the right time. And so the weeks leading up to it, I mean, it was, you know, is a lot of work going into it, and you're spending a lot of time on the road telling the story to investors. And so I don't think I really had the time to really appreciate the gravity of what that moment would mean for me and for my family and for people out there seeing it. And it was really hard. Like, it wasn't a rah-rah, like, experience. It was, we had a lot of skeptical investors. People were hearing the story for the first time. They were meeting me for the first time. And so, you know, by the time we got to the IPO day, like, I was tired. It's funny how weird, this has also not been shared publicly, but my son had hand, foot, and mouth disease, it turns out. I like brought him to the IPO. And
did he give it to everybody?
No, he didn't. But I didn't.
Sorry
really,
for laughing.
I mean, it was my first kid. I didn't know it was so contagious.
Gosh.
And so he was kind of lethargic and a little feverish and had blisters on his hands and feet.
He's okay now. That's the only reason
we're
smiling.
He's totally fine. And I think he was like, I think he had a pretty mild case of it. But we were just, you know, it was just really busy. But that day did feel like that day felt like it moved a little bit in slow motion. And
yeah.
I did get to appreciate that day, you know, just how much had gone into it, and to have mm-hmm. my son and to have my husband there with me. Like, in the time of Stitch Fix, I went from being single to being married to having a kid. And so, you know, they had been so much a part of that journey and that story. And it just, you know, I think it was a day that felt really proud, I guess is the right
yeah.
word, where we had a lot of doubters. We still do, but we had a lot of doubters along the way. There were, you know, probably 50 venture investors who said no to us. And so to be able to feel like, you know, you kind of overcame
yes.
odds.
I'm sure there were some pictures in your head of the faces of the people who had said no. And it's like day one. Bam.
It's
big mistake.
But
huge.
It gave me a lot of motivation. And,
yes.
you know, I think it's I kind of like being the underdog, and I like being underestimated. Honestly, I think it's
yeah.
like I think it's a lot easier to be underestimated and feel like you have fight and grit and you can prove yourself versus I think it's actually harder to be that like overvalued. Everybody expects everything from you place. And so. Anyway, for all those reasons, it definitely was it was a very meaningful day.
Amazon is clearly, for all retail, this sort of 800-pound gorilla. But I wonder, from your vantage point, do you see them as an eventual partner of yours, or do you see them as the competition?
I mean, it's impossible to ignore Amazon. They've done a lot of incredible things in e-commerce in general. You know, for us, like, we're solely focused on personalization. And if, you know, if Amazon is the everything store, like, we are in some ways almost the antithesis of that. Like, in our fixes, we're showing you five things, like, not millions of things, five things to shop from. And even in our kind of evolved product, we're showing you 30 things to shop from. And so it's kind of the opposite of like, oh, we sell everything on the planet. I think our focus on personalization, our focus on apparel, our focus on recommendations at the core of what we do is what's going to differentiate us. And we sell jeans really well. We sell workwear. We sell dresses really well. We sell all kinds of products that people have had a really hard time selling in e-commerce really well. And, you know, we're really proud of that as a sustainable advantage.
How do you think of being a public CEO versus when you were the CEO and founder of a private company? How much has your life and the job changed as a result of that?
It's changed quite a bit. You know, everything that we do is more public. And, you know, things feel a little bit like they have higher stakes. Like, as much as I think it's very rewarding to feel like we are, as a publicly traded company, we have, you know, mom and pop investors. We have, I mean, I have
pension
had people,
funds.
We have pension funds.
And
I have literally 401ks. I've
had
people like at the grocery store tell me that they bought my stock. And so there's an element of that that feels really rewarding. And there's an element of it that makes it feel really just real and high stakes. And so like, I feel a really deep obligation to all of the people that have bought our stock. And, you know, we, part of being profitable in 2014 was that we had a lot of hard, it was very hard to raise money. And so we've always treated every dollar that we have really preciously. So there's a lot of it that feels higher stakes. I also feel like I've learned so much about the value of communications, as an example, internal and external communications, and helping people to understand our longer term narrative. I've learned so much about just value creation of like all these classes that I took in business school around around like DCF models and how do people value companies and value stocks. And now I'm like really learning that firsthand. And so a lot of what I love about my work is that I get to be on this constant steep learning curve. And it's definitely continued to be that way as a public company. And so, you know, it's definitely there's good times and bad times. It's hard when, you know, the everything being very public means that like there the narrative that's public isn't always the narrative that's internal, and it's hard to control that. And, you know, it's hard to control the stock price, certainly hard to control it in the short term. And so, you know, it comes with a lot more kind of sleepless nights. But I think in the end, it's worth it. And if I've learned so much, and I think the company is really better off for it.
What do you think retail looks like 10 years from now? How much will it resemble what it is today?
That's such a good question. The retail world just has to be more personalized in the future.
Yeah.
And like it just has to. The idea that you go onto a shop floor and you're sifting through racks, just the randomness of that, of like just like whatever happens to be on the floor and maybe they happen to have your size, like there's just no way that that is the future.
But for all, I guess part of the reason I pose this question is that for all of the disruption, I don't actually see in the in-store experience, I don't see that much different.
Like, I totally agree.
You can give me a glass of champagne or maybe even a manicure and bring up some new designers on the showroom floor, but it's not that different from what it used to be. It's just a little less convenient.
Right. I completely agree. And I mean, the reason this question is so hard is that 10 years ago, I thought the world would be dramatically different.
Right.
Like 10 years ago, I thought that the brick and mortar retail experience would be like you walk into a store, they already know that you're in there. So you're logged in and then, you know, you can go and you can, you know, engage with like a that there would be no racks of clothes. Mm-hmm. It would all be like a museum. Mm-hmm. That you would be able to see like mannequins in a cocktail party, mannequins doing whatever, and that you could literally just like engage with the mannequins and be like, I like this, I like this, I like that, and kind of swipe your phone or something. You'd show up at a dressing room. It would say like, hi, Rebecca, like here are the things that you swiped and here are some recommendations of things that would go with it. Like this is what I imagine that an in-store experience would look like today, 10 years ago. And that's not even close to what we have today. I think the world has been much slower to evolve in apparel retail than I would have hoped. And I think we can be a big part of what's driving that mm-hmm. forward. And I think in our world, if we can show that, like, you know, culling down to 30 pieces is going to be a much better e-commerce apparel experience, then I think we're really showing what personalization can look like. And I think that people theoretically know. I mean, one of Nike's top five initiatives, one of them is personalization. I think people know that it's really important. And intuitively, like if you could imagine like going to a website and it's only going to show things that go well with things in your closet mm-hmm. or things that you have a high likelihood of liking, like everybody, 100% of like 100% of the market would be happier if the world was more personalized.
Yes.
And so the question is like, how does that come to life? How do people bring that to life, whether it's in stores or in e-commerce? And we're really excited to be at the forefront of that.
So what's the worst advice you've received in your career?
You know, it's funny because I was thinking about this question, knowing that you asked this. I used to say this was some of the best advice that I got, and my mind has changed on it. There is a CEO somebody who had also founded a company who gave me this advice that like, as a CEO, your life is crazy ups and downs of just like one day's the best day ever and the next day is the worst day ever. And his advice was like, don't bring your team along on it. Just like you're up and to the right, like your team doesn't need to know. And I think that was generally some good advice, but I'm now backtracking on it because I really think that some of the best bonding that I've had with the team, some of the way that I've built the most trust with my team is actually bringing them in those like vulnerable moments. And in the IPO is a good example of, you know, we were going to price below the range and our bankers were like, well, you guys don't have to go now. If you don't want to, you could postpone it. And we're like, you know, I mean, it felt like
that's a big thing.
And we were like, we're not going to postpone it. We're just going to go. We don't care if we price below the range. But I remember like me and my CFO, my COO, and we were in, I think we were in Denver and like we were in a hotel and we got all the little half bottles of wine and like poured them into like the coffee cups in the hotel room.
It's and like a scene from a movie.
It really was. And because we were going to have to call the rest of the management team because we were ahead. So it was a 3 p.m. call Pacific, 5 p.m. for us in Denver. And so, and we were going to have to call them and say, like, we're going to have to price below the range. And so we literally poured ourselves our little, like, pity glasses of wine and coffee cups and called the team. And I remember, like, I was holding back tears. I was like, how am I going to tell them, Like, they're going to be so disappointed.
After all this.
After all of this. Like, their stock options are, you know, I don't know if they're underwater or close to underwater. This isn't what they expected. And it wasn't, and the team wasn't sad. And they weren't disappointed. And it was really, like, they provided so much energy to me if they felt like, that's fine. If the market doesn't value us today, like, we'll show them it's fine. We can be a show me stock. We'll, like, you know, we'll prove it to them. I think being able to share some of that vulnerability and having them feel like they're supporting me. And also, I think feeling like we are all in it together mm-hmm. was such an important bonding moment for us. And so, you know, I think now I err more on the side of, like, you're going to have crazy ups and downs. And I think, you know, being able to share authentically with your team about where you are and, you know, not to the point where you want to freak them out, but at least, like, helping them to understand your journey and be and feel like they're part of it, I think is really valuable kind of experience for them. Mm-hmm.
I really agree. And I really respect you for sharing that. It's so tough right now in this world where you, I mean, in order to build camaraderie, in order to build trust, in order to build loyalty, you have to expose yourself, in my opinion, a little bit. And if you don't have any bruises or real honest battle scars, it's very hard for people to fully relate to you. At the same time, once those battle scars or bruises are potentially shared outside of the tent, bad things can happen.
Yeah. And it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I mean, my hope, I guess, for people in your role, for people in mine, for all of us, frankly, is that we sort of cut everyone a little bit of slack in this world going forward, because I just don't see what the end game is if there's no room for that anymore.
And I mean, no one's perfect. And it's just, you know, it's unrealistic to have those expectations of even our greatest leaders. No, I totally agree with you. And I hope, and I do think leaders are starting to understand this. And I think you're seeing a lot more authenticity. And even, I mean, it's silly, but I really think, like, things like Instagram and, you know, and Snapchat and just, like, kind of the real-time social media world actually has helped.
In the stories as opposed to, like, the
stories,
perfect Instagram
for
feed.
For sure, in stories. But I think in some ways it's actually helped to, you know, to demystify and to make people a little bit more accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So I you know, I'm hopeful that things are changing.
As am I. Katrina Lake, this was a great conversation. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
Okay, it's the end of the interview, and that means it's time for our No Limits Entrepreneur of the Week, where we feature one of you, our No Limits listeners, who's building something of your own. And this week's entrepreneur is Sarah Bayett. She's the founder of Kacheko Goods. Kacheko means laughter in Swahili. And Sarah's company is a social impact jewelry business that provides scholarships for under-resourced children. Here she is to tell you more.
Hi, I'm Sarah Bayett, founder and owner of Kacheko Goods, a social impact jewelry brand based here in DC. One of the toughest obstacles I had to overcome was in the beginning. On the day of my first metalsmithing class was also the day that my father passed away. So not only dealing with the challenges of a new small business, learning a new skill set, working with small capital, acquiring new customers, but also dealing with a family loss, it was super tough. I leaned on my husband, my family, friends, and church for emotional support and gave myself time to heal and grieve. And then I also put my head down and started working really hard on it, day in, day out, remembering the why. 5 years later, we are a six-figure business. We have a beautiful studio and shop here in DC, a small team, and I have a baby on the way. So there's been a lot of healing, and I'm grateful for all the lessons learned along this journey.
Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And congratulations to you on what you're building. Congratulations on being this week's entrepreneur. I want to wish you continued success. And thank you to Liz Overman for the nomination. Remember, listeners, you can head over to my Instagram at Rebecca Jarvis to hear more from Sarah. If you or someone you know should be featured here as a No Limits entrepreneur, or you want to submit those nominations, please do so at nolimitswithrjpodcast@gmail.com. You can send me career questions there. We love hearing from you. And finally, a shout out to the team who helps make this happen each week. My producer, Taylor Dunn, editor, Brittany Martinez, research assistant, Lane Wynn. Thank you, ABC Audio. And we'll see all of you here next week.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table.
What is happening here?
It's just beautiful chaos.
Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view.
To be honest, I was thinking about asking him for a foot massage, and then I just froze.
This is the best gig on TV.
And you know, anything can happen.
That is what we do here.
I'm not going to lie, the chair's a little small for my behind.
The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.